This is Tracy Hickman. I'm the creator of Dragonlance and more recently have been writing a Batman novel called Wayne of Gotham. And you and I are both listening to the SF Signal podcast.
This is the SF Signal Podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And this is episode 65, an interview. This did go a little bit longer than our usual episodes, but that's okay because it was a great conversation. I had the opportunity to sit down with Tracy Hickman, who, as you heard at the top of the podcast, created Dragonlance. We talked a lot about TSR and the various games that he was involved in, all that good stuff. So I'm not going to keep you any further since this is a longer podcast. I'm just going to dive right in. Here we go, Tracy Hickman. Tonight on the line, I have a very prolific author, Tracy Hickman. Hi.
Hi, it's good to be with you tonight.
Boy, you know, I was going through just the bibliography, and I'm very tired after reading that.
We don't have time to go through the entire bibliography tonight.
My goodness. Now, just for the sake of listeners, I always like to have the authors, you know, just tell a little bit about who they are, where they came from, and what they do.
Well, I'll do the best I can. I am Tracy Hickman. I was born actually in Salt Lake City back in 1955. An interesting year because it was the same year that the Ford Futura, which was a concept car, was built by the Ghia plant in Turin, Italy. It later toured as a concept car all throughout the United States, and in 1966 was turned into the first Batmobile.
Yes, I knew you were going there. I knew you were going there.
Yes, so it was an auspicious year there in 1955. Born in Salt Lake, my father was going to the University of Utah at the time. We moved around a bit when I was young. He became a manager of an educational channel in Ogden, Utah, KOET. And so we lived in Bountiful and Ogden, Utah for a while. Then he took a job in Las Vegas, lived there for a bit. Moved from there up to Provo, where I went to high school, graduated high school there. Left after high school, I went to BYU for a short time, and then served as a missionary for my church in Indonesia. I still speak Indonesian and often use it as the basis for magical languages in my books because, let's face it, there's just not a lot of people that recognize Indonesian.
I was going to say, that's very clever. Most people use, like, ancient Greek and Latin.
Well, yeah, it's true. But this language is a very interesting language, and it actually works really well as a magical language. So came back from that as a Christian missionary to the most populous Islamic country in the world. And married the girl that I had first met in junior high and had dated through high school off and on. Came home, married her. We've been married ever since. That's Laura, who actually got me into Dungeons and Dragons. That was probably her first contribution to my creative sphere.
And that brings us to TSR.
And that brings us to TSR, those of us who can remember that far back.
I have TSR books sitting right over here on the bookshelf.
Ooh, wonderful. Yes, I was going to school at the time, and I actually used my student loan money to purchase my first edition Dungeon Master's Guide. And I have to tell you, it was actually the best use that my student loan money was ever put to.
You know, I have a set of the original books. The little, they're not very big. They're about the size of like a journal book.
Yes, I've got some of those.
I have that, and then I also have like the official Dungeon Master's Guide, Player's Guide, the big thick books. But I also have the basic sets that they came out with
like
in the 80s.
Like the blue basics.
Yeah, like there was red.
Well, the 80s were the red basics.
I had the red basics, and then the blue was, or it went, It went red and then black and then silver, I think, for beginners and then intermediate and then advanced.
Ah, but before that time, back in the old days when I was first playing D&D, we had what we called the Blue Basic set, which was the first set that my wife gave to me. And she gave me this set for Halloween, I think, because she wanted to buy it for my birthday, but she just couldn't wait that long to give it to me. It was a whole month away. So she gave me the boxed Blue Basic set, which had a truly hideous cover on it. And the rule book inside had a blue cover. It was a blue and white, a blue ink on white cover, because they could only afford one color for the cover, and they didn't want it to be black. So they used blue, which of course made all the difference. And I can, I that set had a D20 in it, of course. It had a set of dice in it. It had a D20 in it with a crayon.
Yes. Mine did too.
You would color yours in, because they could, there's no such thing as actually impressed dice back then. You had to actually color in your own numbers.
Yes.
And I still have that D20. I still have that die.
I have a complete set. Mine came with a complete set. So mine had, it had the D20, it had the four-sided, the six-sided, the eight-sided, the 10-sided.
Mm-hmm.
And they came with a white crayon.
Yes, so that you could color them in white. Yes.
Yep. I still have them. I have what I call my basket O dice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all the die I've collected throughout the year, including a single 100-sided die.
Ah, yes. Yeah, well, see, my D20 has been rolled so many times, it's more like a ball now. It doesn't actually settle on any one particular number, or you can wait for a long time to get a result. Maybe that's more accurate.
So,
but yeah, she got me into D&D with that first set, and we actually were out of work. At the time, I was a theater manager, a movie theater manager, let's face it, not a lot of career advancement possibility.
But hey, free popcorn.
But all the popcorn that you can eat. And I'd actually been fired from I hadn't been fired from that job. I quit that job, and I was out of work, we couldn't go to church that winter. Because I couldn't afford shoes for the children. That's how bad it had gotten. But we had written these adventure modules together. We had written a module called Rahasia. And we had written an adventure called Pharaoh. And we had started work on an adventure called Ravenloft. And so we decided that in order to buy shoes for the kids, we had heard from someone that TSR would pay $500 for an adventure, which, you know, for us was an unheard of amount of money. And so in an effort to buy shoes for the kids, we sent these adventures to TSR to see if they'd be interested in purchasing them. As it turned out, Michael Gray, who is now vice president over at Milton Bradley, had purchased our little home published adventures in a local game shop and really liked them. And so he told the company they should hire us instead. And so they did. That's how I got my job in games is by submitting these, trying to get buy shoes for my kids. I can still remember my talking to my parents over the phone, our neighbor's phone, since ours had been disconnected.
Ugh.
And saying that we were going to go back to Wisconsin to design games. And my father, I can remember him saying over the phone, "Son, don't go back to Wisconsin. I know the guy who owns the Sizzler here in town, and I can get you a job over there as a cook. Come down here, live in my basement, and I'll get you a job as a cook. And you can get on your feet." So faced with the alternative of being a fry cook living in my father's basement in Flagstaff, Arizona, or moving to Wisconsin and becoming a game designer, well, we decided to take our chances in Wisconsin instead.
You know how long it's been since I've heard of anyone mention the Sizzler?
Well, apparently since sometime around 1980, too, because that's when I moved. But
they used to be huge in California where I lived.
Well, they used to be huge everywhere, but they've slackened back a little bit, I think, back from those times.
Oh, I don't think the last one in Fresno closed decades before I even left.
Well, I do live in Utah, and we are a decade or so behind. So there are still Sizzlers here in Utah. If you need that blast from the past, come and visit us here.
I'll tell my mom, because what it used to be, the family thing was to go on Sundays to Sizzlers and get prime rib.
Ah, yes. Well, yes. You can still do that because this is Utah.
There you go.
Uh-huh.
Now, had you ever written anything before you sat down and decided to start writing these game modules just for you and your friends, you know?
No, not really. My wife had wanted to be a writer and had always considered herself to be a writer. When I was in fourth grade, I decided I was going to write a book. And I decided the way one wrote a book is that one wrote a few pages every day. And if you did that every day, just wrote a few pages every day, when you had enough pages, you had a book. It'd be fat enough, right? And so I guess I equated like thickness with a complete book. And so I started on this story. I still have this story. It's called The X-1. And it was about a super fantastic battleship in San Francisco. At least in my mind, it was in San Francisco. I never think that fact got on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to be about a super fantastic battleship because it was all I knew how to draw in the fourth grade.
Was someone watching Star Blazers?
A lot of that, I think, at the time. So suddenly the boat was attacked and the sirens went off and they all ran down and got on the boat and they went to sea. I still remember this one line. It said, "And they were all alone, for they were the biggest boat in the fleet," which I guess meant they didn't get along with all the other smaller boats. I'm not sure what that actually meant. But it went down into the South Pacific. It was attacked by 500 planes and 200 submarines shot torpedoes at it, and it sank. And this was on page 2.
Oh, boy.
And we're talking those, you know, the big pages with the chunky pieces of wood floating in it and the double lines with the dashed line in the middle so you know where to put the B and the P proper.
Yep.
And I was on page 2, and I had writer's block in fourth grade. I tried to salvage the story. I said, well, he got in a lifeboat, and he was picked up, and he went to prison, and he escaped, and then he got another boat. But my heart was out of it by then, and I still hadn't reached page 3. So I decided then that I'd never, ever be a writer. I could never do it. And that's how I felt for quite some time until we started writing these, my wife and I started doing these adventure modules together.
Which brings us to the TSR and Dragonlance.
Yes. Yeah.
And now Dragonlance was an expansion, right? Is that what they considered it?
Well, Dragonlance was interesting. Dragonlance actually started when my wife and I were in our Volkswagen Rabbit driving across the United States to go back to this job at TSR. And in fact, we had decided that we needed to bring something with us, you know, to bear into the company to try to prove, you know, why they would actually pay us money to design games.
Justify it in their minds.
Justify it, and my mind too. And so we did. We came up with this idea of people riding dragons into war and what all of that would entail. And came up with the idea of Dragonlance and the name Dragonlance while we were crossing the plains, the first people in my family in generations to cross the plains the other way, by the way. So when we came into the company, we had this concept. Well, it was about the same time that the company had commissioned a big study. It was very popular back in the 80s, early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, to commission think tank groups to come in and analyze your business for you for an incredible amount of money. And I'd have done it for half. But when we came in, they had just finished this big expensive study. And when the study came in, they distilled it all down to A, Dungeons & Dragons is your flagship product. B, you have lots of dungeons. C, you need more dragons. So the call went out among the designers in the company. What you got with dragons in it?
We need more Tiamat.
We need more Tiamat. Give us dragons. And originally I had proposed, I went in and did the proposal on this and did a proposal on Dragonlance. So I did one proposal. Doug Niles did another proposal, I believe, at the time. And I did this proposal based on 12 modules around the original 12 dragons in the monster manual, the AD&D monster manual at the time. However, in conjunction with this, the adventures that Laura and I had created, we had originally created a thing called Night Ventures, and the idea was to tell story through game rather than to just, you know, go in, beat up the monster, take its stuff, buy bigger weapons to beat up bigger monsters and take more stuff. And we wanted to tell stories through our games. And so that's what we did in the original Dragonlance proposal, rather than kind of have the Dragon of the Month kind of adventure. We wanted to tie the whole thing together with a continuous storyline, an epic storyline. And so that's where the original founding structure for Dragonlance came from. And ours was the thing that was chosen. The truth was that at the time that we were putting all of this together, AD&D had come out and was kind of losing steam at the time. And they were looking for the next big cool game that they were going to do that would be the real flagship product to make the company money. And Dragonlance was seen corporately at the time as a stopgap. It was a product that was supposed to fill in the period of time while they developed the next really good thing. As it turns out, Dragonlance was the next really good thing, especially after the books came out, and we started really seeing the synergy in the product lines.
I'm actually surprised that the think tank didn't come back and say that, you know, D, you need more cowbell.
Well, they might have, but we didn't read that far in the report because we were so hilariously overwhelmed by the first 3 points that we never got to the cowbell part.
So not only were you able to build this expanded AD&D universe, really, mm-hmm. you also got to take that into the Dragons of Autumn Twilight, Winter Night, Spring Dawn, that kind of
stuff. Yeah, the Chronicle series. In fact, it was the first time anyone had attempted to do a novel tie-in with a role-playing game. And we took a lot of arrows at the time for it. And in fact, we had to learn how to tell a role-playing game milieu in story and discover that they actually are two separate things. Mm-hmm. We discovered it's much easier, for example, to write adventure to story than it is story to adventure.
Okay.
The first four Dragonlance modules were written prior to the novels. And I think actually we started the novels about when the third one was underway. And if you notice, I mean, we do now, but you look at the first Dragonlance novel, Dragons of Autumn Twilight, and we have so many characters mm-hmm. all going in the same direction at the same time. It looks like a tour group. I mean, you almost expect Tannis to be holding a little flag, you know, and say, follow me over here. Okay, we're going to go over to Zaxxaroth. Okay, brum, 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 brum. Everybody goes over there. Okay, now where do we go? Well, let's all go back to Solas and brum, 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 follow us over there. And it was too many characters. It was a great balanced party for adventuring, but it didn't work in terms of storytelling. And so the first book doesn't move as well as the books following that. But what happened is that we were writing the novels faster than the adventures were coming out, and so we got to the point after the first novel came out where we were going to be writing the books ahead of the adventures, and that worked ever so much easier because story structure could be what it needed to be, and then the adventures would frame themselves to that, and that worked a whole lot better. But after that, for a long time, and even today to a certain extent, if you're going to do a game, you got to have a book to go with it.
A lot of people do that now, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you even look at like the video games, like Mass Effect, there's a book for it. Halo, there's a book for it.
Yes. Yeah, there is, which I find oddly encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know Tobias Bakel wrote one of the Halo books, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
He's a friend. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. They're great books.
Well, and I did the StarCraft book at one point.
I was going to bring that up because, yeah. I mean, you branched out beyond TSR and you started working on other stuff like StarCraft.
Yeah, StarCraft actually was a lot of fun. I'm a very ethical writer. I like to write about ethics and truth and moral subjects and examine them from different perspectives. And I came into StarCraft. They said, "You want to do a StarCraft novel?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I want to do a StarCraft novel. I love playing the game." And then I started taking a look at the background and the milieu for the StarCraft universe and realized that there were no good guys, that everybody was a bad guy, and that all of the factions really had problems. And so I pondered how I was going to do this and came up with the idea of writing a story about an ethical man in an unethical universe.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the whole thing worked for me. And I just loved that story. I loved what the story said. I loved how it moved. And yeah, it's one of my favorite pieces now.
Which one was that?
That was Speed of Darkness.
Speed of Darkness. And yeah. what was it? Now, I mean, you've played in two different universes. You had TSRs, which eventually became Wizards of the Coast, and now I think is like Hasbro or something like that.
Yeah, they keep changing the nameplates on the door, and it's okay.
And you worked a little bit with Blizzard. So what was you know, how different?
Well,
were those
and now
two
I've been working, and then more recently I've been working with Fantasy Flight Games.
Okay.
And I've done a book for Fantasy Flight Games that's coming out this August.
And what's that one called?
That one's called Fireborn, Embers of Atlantis. And it's in their Fireborn universe, which is a role-playing system that they came out with a while back. And I'm hoping that they'll bring it back. But it's a urban fantasy.
Oh.
It's actually, it's a unique blend of modern fantasy and ancient fantasy because it deals with the ancient times and how the magic was drained out of the world, both good and bad magic was drained out of the world and the world was changed. And this age of mortality essentially has been taking place since. And then in the books, there's an event that turns the world again and then suddenly magic reappears and these magical creatures start reappearing in our modern world.
Hmm.
And it was a thrilling ride for me, especially because I got to write about vampires in the North End of London, for example, and animated zombies in the National Gallery at Nelson's Column, and monsters attacking in the Channel. I mean, it was. I got to go all the places I wanted to go and do the craziest stuff that I could think of in this game. I'm particularly excited about the zombie Nazis in Normandy, for example. I had a great time with that.
So were you writing a novel for the series, or were you writing part of the game?
No, I was writing a novel for the series.
Oh, okay.
Based on their game. I think it turned out great. I'm really excited, actually, to have it. To have it come out. So I've worked with a number of different companies and currently of course I'm working with DC Comics on this Batman novel.
Yep. And I want to talk about that in a second, but
sure.
I know a lot of people over at Blizzard and they are, I think they're a good company I like the games that they produce. They can be frustratingly maddening at some times. Just, you know, with some of the decisions that they make. And I just want to take somebody and throttle them and go, no! But I'm just curious, you know, how that worked. You know, did they approach you? Did you approach them? You know, how was that just working in their universe? Was there a lot of strict guidelines or no?
Well, it was kind of funny. I think you have to work within everybody's guidelines to a certain extent. But then I think just to a certain extent, you also get to work around them. And it's kind of fun, you know, when you get to do that.
Sure.
One of my favorite movies is Casablanca, the Bogart and Ingrid Bergman classic. And one of the things I just absolutely love about the film is the Epstein's dialogue. The dialogue the Epsteins wrote for the film is so rich in subtext that they seem to be talking about nothing at all, and yet they're talking about the craziest, deepest, darkest, you know, parts of humanity without ever saying it.
Right.
You know, and it's really fun though when you, because they got around the production code that way. You know, I mean, we're in the middle of watching this movie, and here's this young bride who's just been married by 2 months, and she's actually asking Bogart about selling herself to get her and her husband out of Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they never say that in the dialogue. It's the most beautiful scene. I just love the dialogue in this particular scene because it is so catastrophically horrifying, and yet they never say it. You have to come up to it. And so it, to a much, much lesser extent, when I did the book for the StarCraft universe, for example, when I did Speed of Darkness, I as I said, I want to do this idea of this ethical man in an unethical universe. And so my historic background, my ancestry and my personal background is that I'm LDS. I'm a Latter-day Saint. I'm a Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I have all that heritage that I draw on. And so I decided, well, you know, we came out west. If we're going to the stars, we'll probably go there too. So I decided that my main character was going to be a Mormon. And that he'd be out here in this Mormon settlement, and then he'd be impressed into the military, and what would that mean, especially if they can like wipe out his memories? So great, I thought this would be really great. I'll have like this like Mormons in space, and you know, since the original Battlestar Galactica did it, I thought I could too, But you know, I sent this manuscript in to Blizzard, and they say, you can't have Mormons in space. There are no Mormons in space. I said, well, how do you know that? There could be Mormons. No, there's no Mormons in space. Oh, well, okay. So I went back and I rewrote those sections of the book, and I took out, you know, anything that overtly looked Mormon, you know, that like said Mormon. But all of the place names that exist in the book are from Mormon culture. All of the people names are from Mormon culture. All of the events that they talk about in different terms are from Mormon culture. And so anybody who actually happens to be a Mormon and is reading this book is going to say, oh, yeah, he must be a Mormon.
So you snuck it in.
I snuck it in anyway. But they were happy, and the book turned out great. So I think, you know, in some ways you work inside the guidelines, and in other ways you work under the guidelines and do what you need to do to make it right.
Now, speaking of guidelines, obviously you are writing about one of DC's I want to say charter characters or foundation characters.
I am writing about an icon.
You are, yeah.
I'm writing about an icon, and not only in DC, not only in terms of DC, but I think in terms of our culture as well.
And I mean, he's been, you know, he's had his back broken. He's had his surrogate son killed.
He's had several different versions of Robin.
Yes.
And in various of various genders, and he has even been replaced on at least one occasion by Alfred, which I find really strange.
Alfred died too. Alfred was killed off, and the TV show wanted him back, and so they brought him back.
Well, and I'm glad they did, because I like Alfred.
Oh, I love Alfred. Alfred's great, you know.
And Alfred figures prominently in our book, so I'm glad he's there.
So, I guess where I'm coming from is, you know, what more can this guy go through?
Yeah, that was kind of my thought, too.
I tell you what, you can't do anything more difficult, or let's see, how do I want to put this? You can't put him through any more crap than Grant Morrison has, and I don't like what Grant Morrison has done to him.
Well, you that's quite true. When I approached Batman, what I wanted to do with Batman was to honor Batman and honor the idea of Batman. And I wanted to write something that would contribute to the mythos of Batman, and to take a look at the Batman mythos in a new way. But when I say that, I say that with a great deal of humility before the idea of Batman, in that Batman still has to be Batman. You can do a lot of things, but it's like the old adage in Hollywood. I want the same, but different.
Sure.
And to a great extent, that's what Batman has to be. He needs to be Batman. And so, for example, they said to me, "We think you should redesign the suit. We think you should redesign the Batmobile." And when I hear this, I'm thinking to myself, wow, I get to redesign the suit. Wow, I get to redesign the Batmobile. And then my second thought immediately after both of those is, oh man, I have to redesign the bat suit.
Okay. So I got some advice for you. Number one, no nipples.
Okay. Well, the nipples went right away. That was the first thing that we got rid of. I got my Dremel tool out and took care of that. The challenge is to make the bat suit, is to update the bat suit in a way that makes sense. And I think I've got it. I think I have it right. Because what I have looks like the bat suit that we want Batman how we want him to look.
Mm-hmm.
But does things differently. I wrote an interesting scene early on in the book where Bruce Wayne is looking at all of these different incarnations of bat suits and thinking, and he's considering the new suit that he's wearing, and he says, "Not quite right yet." and he the same thing with the Batmobile. He looks at the Batmobile, which he thinks is a real joke in the book, by the way, because the term Batmobile is something that the press gave it.
Right.
His are like numbered. He knows them by numbers, by revision numbers. And yeah, he's looking out in the cave at all of these different incarnations of Batmobiles. And he's looking at the new one and saying, "Not quite right yet."
Where continuity-wise is your story falling in? Is it related in any part to what we already know? Is it something standalone? Is it part of the whole idiotic reboot that they're doing right now?
I'm going to let them do their reboot, and I'm going to write my book. And of course, when you talk about continuity in terms of the Batman universe, you kind of have to squint just a bit, because Batman has been around for such a long time, and to make Batman fit in terms of physical age, all of the dates have to shift all the time.
Sure.
And especially in my book, which actually spans a time period from 1947 to the present.
Will he have a gun on his belt?
No, Batman doesn't have a gun. Batman never uses a gun. Never has used a gun.
Oh, he did in the beginning.
Well, he did in the beginning, but not now, because I think that works in terms of his mythos.
Yeah, they retconned it.
Yeah. And the story that I'm telling here is the story of Batman being caused to re-examine his father's life.
Wow.
And so I just the other day wrote a chapter, for example, about Thomas Wayne meeting Martha Wayne in 1957. They've grown up together. They were neighbors together. Martha Kane actually was her name at the time, and she was the daughter of Roddy Kane, I think was his name. They were head of Kane Chemical, and were rich people and lived next door to Wayne Manor. But he meets her in 1957 in a Beat Generation coffee shop. And he shows up in a white dinner jacket, you know, and a bow tie with his hair Brill Cream slicked back. And everybody here has just got, you know, wild hair and t-shirts and jeans, and they got the bongos going, and he is so out of place. And she invites him down into the lower section of this club and introduces him to Denham Sinclair, who is her date, and to Celia, her best friend from the orphanage. He is Celia's blind date, is what he's come to discover.
Ah.
And so all of these characters are from the deep mythology from the books, from the comics.
Are we going to see a young Alfred?
We are. We're also going to see Alfred's father, Jarvis.
Okay.
Early on in the book. The book opens in 1947 with a young Thomas Wayne being dragged into the Bat Caves by his abusive father.
Ew.
Who is trying to make a man out of him and is forcing him to shoot bats.
Ugh.
With the shotgun. And it's that kind of deep resonance that we have going in this book. So we essentially see the courtship of Martha Kane and Thomas Wayne, how they get together. There's someone asked me the other day if I had the scene at the Kane household, the masquerade ball, where Thomas shows up in a bat-like costume.
Right.
And, yeah, that's in my book.
That was also, did they do that in Justice League Unlimited, I think?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, they did, he travels back in time or something.
Yeah, we have, but we're using all of these familiar elements, and I can't tell you how right now, but we're using these familiar elements in a new way that is going to change the way we look at Thomas Wayne, who's always been kind of this saint martyr.
Mm-hmm.
And where we may discover that a lot of Gotham's problems might be traced right back to him.
Mm.
And wow. It's going to be a real crisis for Bruce, as Bruce is struggling with the idea of Bruce Wayne versus Batman, which is the other part of the story that we're telling here. As I've been writing it, I've been just thrilling to what's been put on the page. I can't wait to share that with everybody.
Well, that sounds fantastic. When are you looking at publishing that?
Well, actually, the book should be finished here in the next month. And I believe they were looking at publication in spring. So it could be about 6 months.
Okay.
It's a great story. I think you're really going to like it.
It sounds fantastic. I'm running a little long on my time, so I want to get some other stuff in here. No, it's fine. When we're having a great conversation, I don't want to cut it off.
Uh-huh.
But thanks. I do want to get in some other things that we kind of wanted to mention. You have a serial novel online.
Yes, we're doing actually the second serial novel online right now. It's called Blackshore. We do these serial novels because someone pointed out to us a couple of years ago that the book itself is the souvenir of the experience. It's the thing you put on the shelf to remind you of where you've been, not necessarily how you read it to begin with. And so what we decided to do is to resurrect the way Dickens used to write, and we're doing serial novels online. People will come to our website at dragonsbard.com and can subscribe to the Blackshore book, and we'll release the chapters every week or so as the chapters are being written for the book. But at the end of that time, when all of the chapters are finished and released, we will then mail directly to each one of our subscribers a hardback, limited printing edition of the book that is signed and numbered by my wife and I. And we only print as many books as we have subscribers. So it's like the ultimate collectible.
Sure. And you did this once before.
Yes, we did it last year with a book called Eventide. And actually, for a limited time, you can come to the website and you can. We have a few copies of Eventide left from our first printing. Because, you know, where the print breaks are, you have to print a little bit over. So we have a few copies of that available still. And for a limited time, you can actually buy both. You can buy the Eventide book, and we'll ship it to you right away, and then we'll ship the Blackshore book to you when it comes out. There will be a third book that we're going to do after that called Moordale, which completes the series of three. So if you're actually going to get the whole collection, you probably need to get into it fairly soon.
Very cool.
Yeah. So we're doing that. Not only are we publishing serial novels online, but we teach people how to do it online. We have a publisher workshop that you can buy into, and I will help you set up your own serial publishing, and it's all turnkey. It's pretty amazing.
And where does that live on the web?
Well, you can actually find that at a place called scribesforge.com. All of these links you can get from my website, which is tracyhickman.com or trhickman.com. But if you go to scribesforge.com, not only do we have the publishing workshop there where we can set you up as your own publisher online, but we also have our Scribesforge seminars, our foundation seminars, where we teach you everything I have learned over the last 30 years about writing. We have video seminars that are online that are accessible by our subscribers there. Where you can come and you can learn about story structure and character structure and character interaction and world building and also the craft of writing, what makes a solid manuscript and a professional-looking manuscript and a well-written manuscript. And we also have a section there about the publishing world today, which is evolving and changing tremendously in this new media age. Our objective in our seminars is to not just make writers, but careers. Our objective there is to teach you not just the craft of writing, but how to take that craft and turn it into a profession. Anybody can get published today. And we tell people in our seminars, anybody can get published today. That's not the point anymore. The point is whether you're read, whether you have an audience that is reading your words.
Hmm.
And that is the focus and the objective of our seminars. So, and the most important thing there actually is not just that you have the video seminars and instruction and the workbooks that you can download there, but the most important thing is that you'll have access to me, because I administer the forums there and I answer all the questions there. So if you need to know something about publishing, you need to know something about story structure or about writing, you ask me. And as that's part of your subscription, is that you get access to me.
Wow.
So come to ScribesForge, because that's really an exciting thing for us over there. And not only that, but we even have an affiliate program for...
What's that?
The affiliate program for ScribesForge.
Mm-hmm.
If you like what we're doing over there, and if you think that you have an audience for what we're doing over there, and you know people who would be interested in doing that, you can come in and automatically you can register yourself as an affiliate with ScribesForge. And we will pay you $30, is about what it works out to. It's actually more than that. It's 30% is what we pay as a commission for anyone who signs up. So if you refer somebody to us through our affiliate program, we'll pay you 30% of the registration fee.
Wow.
And we want to do that because we want to get the word out on this. We want people to know that this resource is available to them. And so we're willing to share, you know, the revenues to get that word out.
Very cool. Now, I was going to ask you all your spots on the web. So we've got dragonsbard.com, scribesforge.com, tracyhickman.com. Do you do Facebook or Twitter or any kind of social media?
I do. In fact, I'm very active on Facebook. Please come and be my friend. Doesn't that sound like one's, you know, like junior high school?
Please choose me for your team.
But I am. I'm on Facebook, and you can find me there on Facebook. Please come and friend me, because everybody's welcome there. I'm also on Twitter as well. I think my Twitter is TR Hickman. So come and subscribe there, and we'll keep you up to date. We have pages on Facebook for all of our projects, including XDM, which we didn't even get to talk about.
What's XDM?
Oh, XDM. Go to extremedungeonmastery.com and start with an X, XTREME, extremedungeonmastery.com, or look it up or Google it, extremedungeonmastery.com. That's where you can find Extreme Dungeon Mastery, which is XDM, Extreme Dungeon Mastery, which is a role-playing game book that I wrote with my son and which was illustrated by Howard Taylor, who does the online comic Schlock Mercenary.
Oh, boy.
And XDM is our sort of tongue-in-cheek role-playing game system. But it has a role-playing game system in it called the XD20 system, which I wrote and created. But the important thing there is that it's like STP for role-playing games. Yeah, you remember how role-playing games used to be fun?
Mm-hmm.
That's what this game does for any role-playing game system. That's what this book does for any role-playing game system. It takes everything that I have learned over the last 30 years of role-playing and puts it in this book in a form that you can use. It'll teach you how to do games with story in it. It'll teach you how to make your games fun and exciting again. It'll teach you what kinds of players to look out for and how to adjust for them. It talks about special effects. There's a whole section on pyrotechnics, but it's mostly expurgated. And shows you how to put fun back in your game. Go to extremedungeonmastery.com, and there's a lot on there that you can read about this book there. And you can order the book there. We do big business on this in online, and we also do it on at the conventions. Oh, and it's also available, now that I think about it, on Kindles. And on Nooks.
Well, very cool.
Yeah, so please go find Extreme Dungeon Mastery and download that, because it's just a lot of fun. I didn't realize I was so busy.
You know, Tracy, this has been an awesome conversation, and I think that you and I could probably talk for another hour if
If anyone would listen except you and I, yeah.
Exactly. So I'm definitely going to have you back on.
Absolutely. Do you have show notes for your fabulous podcast?
I do.
I'll tell you what I will do for your fabulous listeners.
Okay.
Is I'm going to go, I'll go ahead and send to you, and we're all finished talking here. I'll go ahead and send to you coupon codes.
Oh, okay.
For both for our online serial book and also for our writing seminars.
Oh, very cool. And yeah, we'll, I can put those in the notes.
We'll give your listeners 20% off on all of those. So it's the way to
go.
Very
cool. Very cool. Well, thanks for coming on with us tonight.
Oh, glad to. Anytime. Let's do it again.
And there you have it, our interview with Tracy Hickman. Hope you guys enjoyed that. If you did, there's a couple things you can do. Number one, you can tell a friend or two about this podcast. That always helps. Number two, you could go to iTunes, give us a couple stars, subscribe to us there. That helps boost our ranking. Maybe write us a review. We appreciate all those things. You should check out sfsignal.com each and every week. Actually, each and every day. You should just go there every day, you know, keep it up on the browser, refresh hourly. There's always something cool hitting. That'd be awesome. You should also follow John D on Twitter, twitter.com/sfsignal. He tweets cool stuff all throughout the day. If you're looking for me online, I'd appreciate that. I am twitter.com/atfmb, which is all things from my brain because I tend to ramble. That's also my blog, www.atfmb.com, and facebook.com/atfmb. Check out the Functional Nerds. That's over at functionalnerds.com. We've got a great podcast over there. And, you know, check out Tracy Hickman's stuff. He's got some cool stuff going on, so check out his websites. I think that's it for me. It's storming like crazy outside right now. The lightning is crashing or flashing. The thunder's crashing. The lightning's just flashing. The rain's coming down. My street is being swept away by water. And over on my left, I have a Google Hangout going. So that's interesting. Google Plus. So that's it. I'm out of here. I'll talk to you guys next week. Bye.